let's talk about what a structural geology PhD student described as beach balls yesterday to me. We're going to look at focal mechanisms. And probably you've met these in structural a little bit, haven't you? Probably know what a beach ball looks like. So these so-called beach balls, or focal mechanisms, as the preferred term is, they're telling us the sense of motion. They're telling us what is going on at the source. And the most traditional way of calculating these things is to assume shear faulting. And many, many earthquake data fit a model of shear faulting. And of course, we can have strike slip faulting, we can have dip slip faulting, or we can have reverse slip faulting. So you can see these things obviously are relevant to structural geology because they can tell you what kind of fault you have. Okay, the stress fields associated with them. So you may be aware that stress fields are described by the three principal stresses, sigma 1, sigma 2, and sigma 3. Have you heard that before? Okay. Sigma 1 being the strongest, sigma 3 being the weakest. And we have normal faulting when sigma 1 is vertical. We have thrust faulting when sigma 1 is horizontal. And we get strike slip faulting when sigma 2 is vertical. And sigma 1 and sigma 3 are both horizontal. So this is how these beach balls are calculated. So here we've got a fault. And the fault is slipping in the sense shown by these arrows. So this bit's going that direction, and this stuff's going that direction. So you can immediately see if we have an earthquake here, and we have sensors, seismic stations all around, that a seismic station in this region here will record a compressional first arrival. It'll look like this, because the first wave to arrive is going to be a push wave. The same will happen in this area here. But in this area here, you know, the earthquake is going like that. So the first arrival at the seismic station here is going to be dilatational, and that's typically like this. So obviously if it's down or up, that depends on the wiring of the seismograph. But you will find that from this quadrant here to this quadrant here, you go from a compressional first arrival, you know, where say the seismic station at the door there and the first arrival is a push, or a seismic station where I'm standing, where the first arrival, you know, is moving, the ground is moving away from me to begin with, and you get what's known as a dilatation. And in order to calculate these beach balls, what you're basically doing is taking all your seismic stations, you're looking to see whether you've got up motions or down motions, and you're mapping them around the earthquake hypercenter. So you can see where the compressional and the dilatational areas are, and you can deduce the orientation of the fault and the direction in which it slipped, the sense in which it slipped. So here we've got three sort of standard end member beach balls. If you see compression in the middle, in the centre of the plot, that's a thrust fault. If you see dilatation in the middle of the plot, that's a normal fault. And if one of these, if the line separating the two, one of the lines separating compression and dilatation goes through the middle of the plot, that's a strike slip fault. Okay, so here we have a coordinate system. So here we have X1, X2, and X3, and this is really just showing you fault planes in these different directions. Here is a horizontal one, here's a vertical one, and it's showing you something called double couple forces. So when people realised first that earthquakes are caused by slip-on faults, they realised this after H.F. Reed's research on the 1906 San Andreas fault break. People argued for a long time about whether the source physics was described as a single couple or a double couple. So people said, well, one side is moving this direction, one side is moving that direction, so that's a single couple. But other people said, you know, it can't just be a single couple, because otherwise you would get rotation in the Earth. There must be a restoring couple. And the people who advocated the double couple, where you have these two couples, one like this, one like this, one like this, and one like this, they won the radiation field looks like. So this is for P waves. Now you can immediately see that you know, if we've got a fault plane here, say, then as I just described, you'll have compression, dilatation, compression, dilatation. So obviously where it goes from one to the other, what is the amplitude going to be where you move from one field to the other?
Zero,
yes. Zero. So the amplitude of the P waves in one quadrant is not the same everywhere. In fact, it's going to have a shape like this, so it's a maximum at 45 degrees, and it's zero in this direction here. And it's described by this equation here. This is the displacement in the radial direction. I've got a diagram here showing you that. It's got this term at the front, 1 over 4 pi rho, which is the density, alpha, which is the P wave velocity, and R, which is a geometric spreading term. So as your station is further and further away, obviously the amplitude becomes smaller, so we've got 1 over R here. Okay, this is the source time function here. So this might be just an impulse, or it might be something of finite length. And these trigonometrical terms here, they describe this four-lobed pattern. And alpha is the azimuth, and phi is the phi is the azimuth here, and theta is related to how steeply the ray is coming up. So this is for P waves, and we have another. So everybody memorize that straight away. Joking. Okay, here's you've got to compare the two. Here we have the same thing for S-wave radiation. So obviously when S-wave radiation arrives at the source, it's not arriving at the station like this, it's arriving at the station like this. So what's plotted on the, you know, this sphere, this is like a sphere around the earthquake hypercenter, are vectors. And here we have the displacement in the as a function of azimuth. Here we have a displacement as a function of takeoff angle, which is 180 minus that. So we have a question here. Here we have the constant term in front, 1 over 4 pi, density, shear wave speed, r, source time function, and here we have the trigonometrical terms describing how this varies over the sphere. So can somebody say why S waves have got a larger amplitude than P waves typically? Never mind about the geometric spreading or the source time function.
Lower velocity.
That's right, yes. Well done, Henry. We have got the wave speed as the denominator, and it's the power of 3. And since the shear wave speed beta is less than the P wave speed alpha, obviously this is going to be bigger because the wave speed's the denominator. So typically, these equations predict an average ratio of about alpha cubed over beta cubed about 5. So the S waves are typically 5 times as powerful as the, or 5 times higher amplitude than the P waves. Okay, so here we're looking at P and S. So sort of 3-dimensional figures. And in practice, the amplitude of the S waves is proportional to the gradient of the P wave amplitude. Focal sphere. So the focal sphere, as I touched upon a few minutes ago, you imagine your earthquake hypercenter as being a point, typically, and you imagine this sphere around it. And this is known as the focal sphere. And what we're doing with these, when we make these beach ball thingies, is we're actually mapping the takeoff angles on the focal sphere. So here we're looking at a lower hemisphere situation. Okay, the earthquake is at this point here. Looking at the lower hemisphere. When you locate an earthquake, earthquake program will typically output the takeoff angle, which the earthquake is in the centre here. You would look at your printout, or a computer program would do this, and it would say, okay, now this station is has got an azimuth of 30 degrees from the earthquake, so that would be 10, 20, 30 degrees here. And it might say, well, the takeoff angle is 120 degrees, so this is a takeoff angle of 90, that's a takeoff angle of 100, 110, 120, so 120 degrees. What is 180 minus 120? 60, yeah, so the angle from vertical downwards, that's 60 degrees. So the azimuth is this, and what you do, you take this and you spin this around to 30 degrees, and you count 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, and you would plot your earthquake, you would plot your station there, and you would plot a black dot if it was a compressional first arrival, and an open circle if it's a dilatational first arrival. That's how it's done, and you'll be doing one in the practical. The trouble is, when people present these things, they usually just colour in the quadrants like this so you can't see the data. So this is where we get this beach ball effect, where you've got these black and white quadrants, and the trouble is you can't see the data. You know, this there could have been one station and one here, or it could be completely covered with stations and really well, you know, accurately constrained. You can't tell if you can't see the data, so this isn't really terribly good. And it results in graduate students coming into my room and saying, you know, can I have the beach balls? So this is a play school or something. P and T axes, these are points basically at the middle of these quadrants. The T axis is a proxy, if you like, for sigma 3, and the p-axis is a proxy for sigma 1. So this is not sort of rigorously 100% correct, but sigma 1 will lie within the dilatational quadrant, and sigma 3 will lie within the compressional quadrant. So it's often assumed, just in order to have something to work with, that you can take this p, so-called p and t axis. And this is just very, very simplistic to give you an intuitive feeling for what is going on. Nowadays, people have programmed up a lot more sophisticated ways of doing this, including modelling the entire waveforms. So the usefulness of modelling the entire waveform is that usually you haven't got stations all over the focal hemisphere that you're working with. You might only have a very small number of stations. And here we've got six stations, for example, and if you just had the polarities for these six stations, there would be a tremendous range of possible solutions you could get. You wouldn't be able to narrow it down much. So people have developed methods where they actually model, you know, the first several wiggles of the seismogram, and then you can get focal mechanism with fewer data, fewer stations, that is. Focal mechanisms allowed sorting out of the transform versus transcurrent controversy. Do you know what that is? No? Okay. So, when people first saw ridge transform, they saw that the mid-ocean plate boundaries had got this sort of geometry. Some people said, well, these ridges are fixed position, and this stuff's moving like this, and this stuff's moving like that. Some people said that was known as the transform theory. And other people said, there's a displacement here, so these ridges are moving like this, they're getting further and further and further away. And if you think about it, which I'll let you do in your own time, if you had the so-called transcurrent theory, it would predict a different sense of movement on this fault. Transform theory predicts motion like this, and the transcurrent theory predicts motion in the opposite way. And a geophysicist called Lynn Sykes sorted this out by taking a few big earthquakes from these zones and calculating the focal mechanisms, and he produced things like this. So this was a controversy which was instantly dealt with, which is not always possible in earth sciences, as you all probably know. numbers of violations. When you get to one of these so-called beach balls, you almost invariably find that you've got a compression here and a dilation here, often because seismic stations are wired up backwards. You have to worry about that. You know, what's a violation and what's a bona fide data point? If you just have polarities, you can only get a best fit solution because, you know, you've just got some plus or minus points on this focal sphere, and you could, you know, fit quite a range of different solutions. You'll be finding this out in the practical work that you do. And the double couple assumption is controlling the answer. So this is all based on the assumption that this slip is on a shear fault. So if that's not true for some reason, then you know you can kiss goodbye to all you know this theory which is telling you how to plot your beach balls out. So probably this is a good place to stop here. When I did my PhD, I was very fortunate to have in my to collect a data set which was impossible to interpret. Okay? My data set, my PhD data set, was impossible to interpret, and that was a huge stroke of good fortune, which probably did immeasurable good to my career, because after refusing to be beaten by this data set, it just so happened that the time was ripe, and about a year after I'd sort of shamefacedly hidden this data set in a drawer, having been told by my supervisor I must have set all the equipment up wrong, a paper was published in Nature which showed that some earthquakes have non-double couple sources because they're not caused by shear slip on a fault plane. So I was immediately able to haul this all out of the drawer, see that this new theory fitted my data, and I instantly got a paper in Nature out of it. So if you want a really cracking project, collect some data that is really, you know, totally problematic to analyse, something which is not straightforward. But anyway, this is a good place to stop, so I'll let you have your 10-minute break, and we'll talk about that next week.